Chapter 6. Evil. Remember, at the beginning of the book, there were two core objections to God's existence. First, that the world can be explained without him. Second, that there is evil in the world, and that doesn't seem to be compatible with a good God. The past three chapters have been mostly about the first objection. This chapter is about the second one. But before I get into that, a word of warning. The title of this book is Thoughtful Theism, Redeeming Reason in an Irrational Age. The first word in the title is meant to contrast with a lot of other possibilities, thoughtless, for example. But one thing it will have to contrast with in this chapter is emotional. The problem of evil, as it's called, seems to me at its root an emotional, not an intellectual problem. Yes, it is a serious objection to the existence of God that needs an answer. But in my experience, the real issue with most people is not evil as an abstract idea that seems to object to a good creator, but personal suffering. And it's hard, if not impossible, for a person to be completely cool and objective in the face of personal suffering. That being said, I need to warn anyone reading this chapter that I won't be mincing words. There is a nice way to say everything I plan on saying here, but I'm not going to say things nicely. I'm going to say them bluntly. It's not because I want to be mean, but because I want to deal with evil as an objection to God's existence, not as something that has hurt you personally. That is a matter for counseling, which I do plenty of as well. It's just not the topic of this book, so nothing personal. I'm also going to speak bluntly because the objection is a blunt one. It's been reformulated hundreds of times over the centuries, but here's the way Hume says it, again through his character Philo. Quote, "Is God willing to prevent evil, but not able? Then is he impotent. Is he able, but not willing? Then is he malevolent. Is he both able and willing? Whence then is evil?" End quote. Strictly speaking, this is not an objection to God in the sense of the prime mover, or first cause, or necessary being. This is, if anything, an objection to the fourth proof, that of ultimate good. Strictly speaking, this is not an objection to God in the sense of the prime mover, or first cause, or necessary being. This is, if anything, an objection to the fourth proof, that of the ultimate good. The deist doesn't have any problem with evil, since his God doesn't care about us anyway, and isn't good in any meaningful sense. But it is a problem for traditional theists like Aquinas, and for anyone with a revealed religion or a personal God. Aquinas' answer to this objection is characteristically concise. Quote, "As Augustine says, since God is the highest good, he would not allow any evil to exist in his works, unless his omnipotence and goodness were such as to bring good even out of evil. This is part of the infinite goodness of God, that he should allow evil to exist, and out of it produce good." End quote. God allows evil in order to produce some greater good. On some level, this is easy enough to imagine. The rain ruins the picnic but waters the crops. The animal dies, and other living beings find sustenance in its body. But in the end, is it all worth it? Or, phrased differently, does the balance of good and evil tip toward some evidence of a loving God in the end, or not? Bertrand Russell thinks not. Quote, "When you come to look into this argument from design, it is a most astonishing thing that people can believe that this world, with all the things that are in it, with all its defects, should be the best that omnipotence and omniscience have been able to produce in millions of years. I really cannot believe it. Do you think that if you were granted omnipotence and omniscience and millions of years in which to perfect your world, you could produce nothing better than the Ku Klux Klan or the fascists?" End quote. I suppose in passing, someone could answer Russell and point out that, in fact, God has produced plenty of things better than the KKK and the fascists. But that is beside the point. The point is, Bertrand Russell does not approve. One could here become especially snarky and ask when God asked for his approval in the first place, and what gives him, an imperfect being who exists and, according to his own belief system, ceases to exist in the blink of an eye, cosmologically speaking, any right to think he can judge the relative good and evil in the big scheme of things. Hume, speaking again through Philo, seems to me to even satirize the point Russell makes seriously. Quote, "A being, therefore, who knows the secret springs of the universe might easily, by particular volitions, turn all these accidents to the good of mankind and render the whole world happy without discovering himself in any operation. A fleet whose purpose were salutary to society might always meet with a fair wind. Good princes enjoy sound health and long life. Persons born to power and authority be framed with good tempers and virtuous dispositions. A few such events as these, regularly and wisely conducted, would change the face of the world, and yet would no more seem to disturb the course of nature or confound human conduct than the present economy of things, where the causes are secret and variable and compounded." End quote. At some point, the problem of evil just gets absurd. Not only does the objector expect their good God to miraculously intervene any time someone they dislike wins an election, but they expect him to adjust the winds so that their ships can make it to harbor without inconvenience. This is beginning to look less like a good God and more like a pusillanimous waiter, desperately bringing us anything we might desire so that we can give him the honor of believing in him. If this is the God the new atheists expect, I don't blame them for not wanting to worship him. I wouldn't even talk to him. But to deny the existence of God on a basis like this reveals much more about the person denying than about the God denied. That God doesn't immediately bow to every one of my wishes or suspend the forces of nature whenever it is convenient for me is exactly what any of us should expect. But seeing this basic reality and concluding there is no God is equal to saying, I can't imagine a God who doesn't make the universe revolve around me. To call this narcissism would be an unjust compliment. St. Augustine says it smartly. Quote, "Something very similar to this is found in the case of uninstructed men, who on account of their feeble mentality are unable to grasp and to study the integral fittingness of things. They think that the whole universe is disarranged if something is displeasing to them, just because that thing is magnified in their perception." End quote. But what if the example of evil isn't so trite? What happens when evil is something inescapably horrifying? Dostoevsky, speaking through Ivan in The Brothers Karamazov, gives this example. Quote, "This poor child of 5 was subjected to every possible torture by those cultivated parents. They beat her, thrashed her, kicked her for no reason till her body was one bruise. Then they went to greater refinements of cruelty. Shut her up all night in the cold and frost in a privy, and because she didn't ask to be taken up at night, as though a child of 5 sleeping its angelic sound sleep could be trained to wake and ask, they smeared her face and filled her mouth with excrement. And it was her mother did this. And that mother could sleep, hearing the poor child's groans. Can you understand why a little creature who can't even understand what's done to her should beat her little aching heart with her tiny fist in the dark and the cold and weep her meek, unresentful tears to dear, kind God to protect her? Do you understand that, friend and brother, you pious and humble novice? Do you understand why this infamy must be and is permitted? Without it, I am told, man could not have existed on earth, for he could not have known good and evil. Why should he know that diabolical good and evil when it costs so much? Why, the whole world of knowledge is not worth that child's prayer to dear, kind God. I say nothing of the sufferings of grown-up people. They have eaten the apple, damn them, and the devil take them all. But these little ones." End quote. The suffering of children is, for the reasons Ivan explains, the evilest of evils. And so if we are going to really face the question, this is the face the question must take on, the face of a suffering child. This is a different story entirely than the examples of political elections and favorable winds cited above from Hume and Russell. Victor Stenger quotes a website run by Evan Fales, who expresses this dramatically. Quote, "But God is not hiding out of solicitude for our freedom. We have not forgotten Job. Therefore, we understand that God is hiding out of cowardice. God is in hiding because he has too much to hide. We do not seek burning bushes or a pillar of smoke. No, we wish to see God. Can God stand before us? Can God see the face of suffering humanity and live? End quote. This quote is expressive of the problem at hand, because it cleverly reverses the biblical image of humanity being unable to see the face of God and live, an image meant to express the majesty of God in comparison with created beings. Is this a reasonable image? Does it make sense, according to reason not emotion, to imagine God as having to answer to us, even for the most horrific events? Even in the case of a personal God? No. We are speaking of a being of infinite power, one who is the cause of the entire universe, from every force to every particle to space and time themselves. We are not complaining against our neighbor building a shed on our property without our permission. There is no proportion between us and no answer required, not according to reason. Emotion here needs simply to be put in check. The Old Testament expresses this idea at the end of the book of Job. This idea, in fact, is the whole message of that book. And as much as the book of Job has been mocked and misrepresented, its message is one that is supremely reasonable. After nearly 40 chapters of complaints and explanations from Job and his idiot friends, the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins like a man. I will question you, and you shall declare to me, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Job 38:1-7. Like I said, this chapter might be a little harsh. Let me tell you a story. I remember being on a train with some friends, one of whom was struggling intensely with his belief in God, and specifically with the problem of evil. We decided to go to a quiet car toward the back of the train and talk it out. The friend in question is a very intelligent and kind man and grew up in an exceptionally religious Catholic family. I remember his objections being sincere and well-formulated, and our discussion being intense, but never angry. At some point in the discussion, while I was attempting to explain how God can bring good out of evil, and he was objecting that my explanation didn't make sense to him, I responded, "Is it reasonable to think that God's activity would always make sense to us?" It has been about a decade since that conversation, and I realize now how potentially dangerous my question was. I meant it, and I still think there is a deep truth in it. But it needs to be said more clearly than I said it that day. Left vague, my question implies the possibility that God is, or could be, utterly disconnected from rationality. I certainly didn't mean it that way, but in the 10 years since that train ride, I've understood just how dangerous an irrational God can be, and therefore choose my words more carefully, lest I imply such a God in any way. What I meant when I said that, and what I want to say now, is that it is unreasonable to think that God's activity would always make sense to us, stress on the always. Without this stress, we are left with the God of Occam, who is beyond even the laws of logic. We are left with a God who can create a square circle, an immortal mortal, a free will that can be forced to choose. On the contrary, the God we find in Aquinas and related thinkers is a God who is supremely rational. A God who is logos, which is the Greek word meaning word, but also reason. With this clarification, I hope, clearly made, I can explain what I meant to say on that train. If an adult has a hard time explaining something to a toddler, why, for example, she must undergo some surgery, then perhaps there are things that God cannot make us understand as much as he might try. This is not because these things are irrational, but because we cannot see everything he sees. All the pain of the surgery might be completely necessary for that little girl, but she doesn't have the capacity yet to understand why. Perhaps the pain we feel, The darkness we discover all over the world is not irrational, but simply beyond our localized vision and partial understanding. Perhaps God knows more than we do, in a proportion infinitely greater than that between us and that toddler. In fact, it would be irrational if it were not so. It is unreasonable to think we could understand everything the way God understands it. Does this make the pain any more bearable? Not really. But this chapter isn't about making the pain bearable. It's about answering an objection to God's existence. We can figure out quite a bit in our world, but I don't know why everything happens the way it does. I can't know. Neither can you. And that is not unreasonable considering the kinds of minds in question. But this brings me to one of my deepest pet peeves. More than that, it's something that makes me completely furious. Whenever some national or international tragedy occurs, for example, when a hurricane hits a city, it's just a matter of time before some TV evangelist pretending to represent some religion or other, in America it's usually Christianity, goes on the air and explains to the rest of us why God did what he did. Generally, it has to do with the sins committed in that city or the fact that the wrong politician was elected. This monstrous arrogance is a deeper aberration even than the narcissism I discussed earlier in this chapter. Here, you're not upset because God doesn't explain himself to you. You're happy because God has obeyed you. In case there's some doubt whether this attitude is authentic in Christianity, and in case the thunderstorm of God's answer to Job wasn't enough, we can bring Jesus into the picture. Quote, "There were some present at that time who told Jesus of the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. And he answered them, 'Do you think that these Galileans were worse sinners than all the other Galileans because they suffered thus? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you will all likewise perish.' Or those 18, upon whom the tower in Siloam fell and killed them, do you think that they were worse offenders than all the others who dwelt in Jerusalem? I tell you, no, but unless you repent, you will all likewise perish." Luke 13:1-5. People ask Jesus about some other people who were murdered and whether this happened to them as a punishment for their sins. Jesus answers an unequivocal no. He brings up another example of a kind of natural disaster of a tower that fell and asks his audience the same question, answering it again with a clear, resounding no. In both cases, Jesus adds the phrase, "Unless you repent, you will all likewise perish." The sins of others and the tragedies that befall them are not our business to understand. Our own sins are. So do everyone a favor and stop interpreting God's will. It was never your job, and it never will be. In fact, when we back off like this, things often make a lot more sense. My friend back on that train asked me about the Holocaust. In fact, I believe the train was just then leaving Poland and we had just visited Auschwitz, and asked how he could believe in God, knowing that that had happened. I answered, as I always do, that I don't know. But I pointed out that some of the people who were there, who had survived the Holocaust, still believed in God. The evil had hurt them directly. It wasn't an abstract concept or something they had read in a book, and they still believed. What excuse did he have? As easily as the book of Job is dismissed, its main lesson is one we seem to need more than ever. God is not a buddy who either owes us an explanation or whose motives are ours to explain. But there's more to be said than simply shut up and accept it. Look at the question, where is God when bad things happen to good people? And try to answer it as reasonably as we can. There are two important distinctions to make. First is the distinction between God's action in nature and his action through miracles. When we ask, "Where is God?" the primary answer in every case is, "He is outside time and space creating the world." Every particle is dependent upon God for its existence, as are the forces of nature. Without him holding them in being, they and the whole universe would cease to exist instantaneously. This is more or less implied by the material in chapter 3. Within this creative act, the forces of nature, the working of space-time, and everything up to human free will are counted as given, standard realities that are there whether we like it or not. Could God have created a world where the strong force of the nucleus was 1/10,000th weaker or stronger? Perhaps, but that would have resulted in a world with no life. He chose to create a world with life. Could God have created a world with life, but with no consciousness or free will? Yes, but he chose to create this one, for better or for worse. In a world with no life, there at least would have been no death. In a world with no free will, there at least would have been no sin. But that isn't our world, and it was never our choice to begin with. It was always his choice. And arguing with the Creator about how he should have created when we only learned to tie our shoes a few years ago is unreasonable to the point of absurdity. The beginning of wisdom is to just grow up and accept that the world is the way it is, and then go on from that starting point. Here's where I empathize with Ivan Karamazov. I have, with a broken heart, counseled dozens of people that were molested, abused, or raped as children or as adults. God created a world where the forces of nature work with regularity, and a world where free will is free, and the results are that these people were hurt terribly. If I were to balance it, I might vote that it were better not to create a world at all if this were the result, or create a world without life or free will. But I didn't get a vote, and that makes perfect sense because I don't see anything close to the big picture. God didn't ask my advice when he created the world, and he didn't need it. If I see that the balance is tipped and it all wasn't worth it, he thinks it was, and he's smarter than I am. It's also self-centered for me or anyone to have expected God to suspend the fabric of the universe every time anything evil occurred. That is either asking the world to revolve around you, or again, asking free will to be obstructed. Miracles, if they exist, I believe they do but haven't discussed them directly, are a secondary mode of God's activity, and a very distant second. In fact, I'd argue that miracles are third, but more on that later. A miracle, according to one version at least, is when the ordinary working of nature is supervened for the sake of something else, generally for establishing the faith or something related to that. They are not freebies or song requests for the divine DJ to play for us. It's very important to understand that by their very nature, miracles are extremely rare. I am certain I have never witnessed one, and I don't expect to. I think people's imprecision in using the word miracle for everyday events that can be easily explained otherwise is harmful and scandalous, and is another one of my pet peeves. I suppose I have a lot of them. Of course, just because something isn't a miracle doesn't mean it isn't God's work. Remember, his primary activity is in creating nature. As you know from chapter 5, I don't believe that life is, strictly speaking, a miracle. It came about through ordinary natural processes. But nobody talks about that because they are caught up in political debates about the curriculum of public schools. It is here, within the issue of miracles, that the problem of evil becomes the most stark. Could God miraculously intervene every time any bad event occurs? Every tornado, every murder, every tyrant? Yes, he could. Would it cost him anything to do so? No, it wouldn't. Why doesn't he then? I don't know. But I do know that he doesn't need to answer to me, and he doesn't owe me anything. On the contrary, he gave me everything I have, and he did the same for you. The debt is entirely on our side. That being said, one might ask why we religious people pray. Prayer, as I understand it, is primarily to thank God for creating us, and secondarily to ask for the strength for ourselves and others to be instruments of good in the world. This is grace and completely outside the scope of this book. Praying for a miracle is allowed, but I don't generally recommend it. It just seems bratty. Please, God, I know you're using infinite power to create the entire universe right now, but I need you to suspend the forces of nature and rip into the fabric of space-time because I would like a sunny day for my picnic tomorrow. Even worse, and this applies more directly to many of our questions, is asking God to do something that is a logical impossibility. Miracles are one thing, since the forces of nature are his creation in the first place. But God can't make a square circle, because it can't be made. And he can't force a being with free will to choose a certain way. Forced freedom is like a square circle. It can't exist. To answer an old question very simply, God can't make a stone so heavy that he can't lift it. Square circles, forced freedom, and God-proof stones are all logically impossible, and the God of traditional theism is logos, reason itself. One thing I've already alluded to is the idea of being God's instrument of good in the world. This is entering the topic of religion proper, but a word on it won't hurt as I conclude this chapter. Just as God works through the forces of nature and the world he created, he can work through human instruments. Thus, in between the two activities of creation and miracle is the activity of God by means of human beings. This is where I completely agree with the statement not to wait around for God to do something, but do it yourself. That's exactly how God might want to work, through us. To sit around praying for a miracle when we could just go do something ourselves is analogous to a lazy child calling his mother from the kitchen to get him the remote control that is sitting 2 feet away from him. Get off your rear end and get the remote yourself. The same goes, I believe, for bringing good into the world. Those of us who pray should do so knowing that God wishes to answer our prayers through us. Ivan Karamazov brought up the objection of suffering children to his brother Alyosha, but he did nothing in the novel to help anyone, especially children. In fact, it was the religious Alyosha who took the time to help the children in their town, while his atheist brother Ivan found some strange enjoyment reading and collecting articles about children who had suffered. Maybe, instead of wasting all his time fighting with God, he could have helped some people instead.